This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 300. 300. You heard that right. 300 of the Outlander podcast. I am still Ginger.
And I am reluctantly Summer. And we are in love with all things Outlander.
I mean, you gotta be with 300. That's kind of, it's bonker donk anyway, but it's really bonker donk if you're not in love with Outlander and you get together this much or do this many recordings.
The 2019 FabFitFun Summer Box is on sale now. Treat yourself with items such as the West Elm Indigo Tie-Dye Bowls. It's a set of three indigo tie-dye-inspired ceramic bowls used as table shelf decor or to serve snacks in or dip for tabletops. I just love little bowls, but I use them for meal prepping. Set all of my things out ahead of time so that they're already pre-measured and ready to go.
Do you love discovering new products? Are you a beauty and fashion maven constantly on the hunt for the next best thing? Ever read about or spot something online that you've always wanted to try but never have? Then you must try FabFitFun.
FabFitFun allows women everywhere to discover new products, as well as including rave review, must-have brands that you know and love. It's like Christmas four times a year.
And what I love especially that I didn't think I would love or didn't even know that I could love were these Invisibobbles. It's like a rubber band without the damage, but it's like, you know, like think about the old-fashioned telephone cord, like the coil. That's what this looks like. And it really, it doesn't damage your hair and it kind of fades in if it's a similar hair color, similar color to your hair. So are you stumped on gift ideas? FabFitFun is a great gift to yourself or to a loved one. Surprise your mom or sister with the summer box as a gift or to show thanks. Do you have a daughter who's going to college or a friend who's a new mom? FabFitFun is an awesome care package.
FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box delivered four times a year with full-size beauty, fashion, home, fitness, and wellness products for just $49.99 a box.
Sign up for FabFitFun today. These boxes always sell out. Use our code Outlander to get $10 off your first box.
Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use promo code Outlander to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99.
Go to FabFitFun.com and use our code Outlander to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along with Chapter 28 and 29, but starting with 28, entitled Brownsville.
So what we started last week, well, not this chapter, but in this episode, what we started last week, we're going to finish tonight. Although we also open up some more cans of wormies, so let's get gurn. So meanwhile, in Brownsville, Roger and Fergus and the other militia dudes arrive in Brownsville. On the way there, they'd gone kind of on an accidental walkabout. They basically almost got lost. And it wasn't until they met two Cherokee, they were able to get pointed back in the right direction.
Now, was this the first mention of Cherokee in Diana's actual books?
That's a good question. I do not know.
Okay.
I didn't do a search. I know up until now we've had the, no Ginger, the Tuscarora.
Yeah.
And the Mohawk.
It was definitely Tuscarora and Mohawk before. But this, I know that they shifted with production to being pure Cherokee. So I wonder, but my brain made me wonder when I read this the first time, if Diana figured out.
Oh, changed?
Yeah. That she was like, oops. Not the Tuscarora, and was like, it was a Cherokee, and just like shifted over and shifted to Cherokee with this book?
Possibly, because it's still part of the same book, so if it may or may not be the same reason, but it makes sense if it were. Because when we don't meet him. We actually do meet him. When we are first finding out about Mr. Beardsley, he was a traitor with the Cherokee. And that's in a chapter or two ago. So yeah, so it's definitely been at least mentioned in this book before, but as far as earlier in this book, how earlier, I don't know. But yeah, it definitely seems like the Cherokee are going to be the people, and we'll keep a little eyeball on that. We'll see how it progresses throughout the rest of this novel. So what does Brownsville actually look like? Well, Diana gives us a little bit of an idea of this early, early colonial settlement. Quote, half a dozen ramshackle huts strewn among the dying brush of a hillside like a handful of rubbish tossed into the weeds. Near the road, two cabins leaned tipsily on either side of a slightly larger and more solid-looking building, like drunkards leaning cozily on a sober companion, unquote. So it doesn't sound like it's the most well-built, shiny place. And you wouldn't expect that kind of out in the boondoggies. They believed, Roger et al., they believed that the larger building, so the one in the middle one, was likely a tap room and general store, given that there were barrels of beer and gunpowder in front of it. So the sight of the beer made the men kind of start to tweak. They were drawn to it like zombies to brains. Or they were being drawn to it. They hadn't moved yet, but they were like, yeah. So Fergus alerts Roger. Basically, he's like, don't move. Don't move. He'd seen two people with guns pointed at them. So Brownsville is hella welcoming. Don't you agree?
Not so much.
Just a smidgel? No, not at all. So hands in the air then. That's what they did. And Roger introduces himself. As he's about to speak, someone yells, I see you, Morton, you bastard. Huh? Ah, Isaiah Morton. Guns went off. Horses went cray. Roger goes down and then gets up and runs toward the door. Now, once he opens it, once inside, he sees the men with the guns and he grabs one of them and demands, what the F? Two women go for his gun, and a third throws her apron over her head and shrieks hysterically.
What did you do?
One of the things we talked about in our discussion of the last chapter was how, I mean, very briefly, because it was not germane to last chapter, but it was kind of off stage, off page, was how Jamie remarked, at least to Claire, that Roger, you know, he needed an opportunity to prove himself, but at the same time, he hadn't done it yet. And so it's not funny at all, but I think he got his time. I mean. So what do you think about, like, they finally get to the place that they, at least their goal, his goal without Jamie, like his one task was to take the men, go to Brownsville, you know, set up, meet them, tell them why you're there, and wait for me. And I'll be there. But it's your task to lead these men. He didn't expect, you know, that kind of welcome. Maybe not open arms, but to be shot at without even really getting to say who you are.
I mean, honestly, that shouldn't be too surprising. I mean, that's something that happens today. You don't just show up on somebody's property in the middle of nowhere and expect to be like warmly welcomed. Everyone meets you with a little bit of suspicion. However, I feel personally bad for Roger for being the extension of Jamie Fraser's, like his like right hand man, and being like, dude, I'm going to screw this up so bad. What do I have to do? Because he doesn't know. He's not from the time period. He doesn't know these people, and he doesn't have the skill set in his toolbox, right? So he doesn't have the Jamie Fraser toolbox at hand. So he doesn't know everything that Jamie Fraser knows. So he doesn't have the same types of resources to pull from. So he's just like sitting there going, oh my God, all I need to do is just keep everybody alive and not killing each other until Jamie gets here. I just need everyone to get along until Jamie gets here because he'll know what to do. And I mean, I feel like he's got that WWJD, except it's not Jesus, it's Jamie.
That's funny. I wrote that in this. What would Jamie do? I wrote that in my notes. Mm-hmm. Not yet. It's coming up. But yeah. And I thought when you said right-hand man, I thought, oh gosh, he's like a really, really and this is no shade at Roger at all, but he's like,
he's underqualified for this position. He may be a teacher, but he's not a rabble rouser and or a militiaman.
What I was going to say was Roger's very, very smart, very bright, very capable, and very talented. However, and Alexander Hamilton, he is not.
No.
He just is not. Now, Hamilton wasn't a Roger. Well, one's fictional, one's real. But you know what I'm trying to say? As far as their character, what they, or not even their character, their, like, I guess their abilities. So the reason I brought up Hamilton is because you said right-hand man, and I thought, oh, because Jamie, I could absolutely compare him in almost all equality with George Washington. Leader of men, smart in battle. I think he's probably smarter than Washington as far in general, but I don't know enough about Washington. Haven't listened to his biography yet, so let me, I'll get away with that for now. Anyway, I just thought of that when you said right-hand man. I was like, huh, he's like a Hamilton as far as the position, but not quite the ability. Smarts-wise, he's just not a Hamilton, but it doesn't mean that he's not smart. You know what I'm saying? He's different. Anyway, that's what I thought of. And so I also kind of have a little bit of Hamilton on the brain, but there's not a reason for that at all. So that's the situation we're in right now. Into this situation, Fergus strolls in. So he's inside. So Roger is shot at, drops to the ground, gets back up, runs and bursts of his door, sees the men with the guns at him, goes after one of them, and the two women are kind of like WTF, and the third one throws her apron over her head and starts screaming or crying or whatever hysterically. So this is a scene. This is drama. In strolls Fergus. Not runs, not rushes, strolls.
Just like waving a gun around with his hook in the air.
Because of course, he's Fergus. And he politely tells them to put their guns down and says, please, someone pour water on that woman. At first when I was reading, it was like, pour, give that woman some water. And he's like, no, pour it on her. Yeah, that is what she needed. In answer to, who are you? Fergus waves his hook around, which fascinated the women. Quote, it is of no importance, unquote. No, 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 de rien. Ça va dire rien. Whatever, that was probably not the best friend.
It was not.
You did not even know what I tried to say. You stop it. So he demands to know who they are, which is funny because they're in, that's not their town. So, I mean, it just made me laugh. I'm like, only Fergus could get away with this. So he demands to know who they are, and then they start, quote, my name is Brown, sir, Richard Brown. This is my brother, Lionel, wife, Meg, and my daughter, Alicia, unquote. So now we know the Browns of Brownsville. Fun times. And a great start to this relationship. Ugh. The Browns are not going anywhere anytime soon. That's all I'll say. And it had been Alicia. We didn't get a name at first. It had been Alicia who had been the hysterical one. Roger again announces their purpose there. So I take it back. He had announced their purpose after she says who he is before they're shot at. So he again announces their purpose. And Richard was surprised. And Lionel was pissy. Fergus suggests maybe we should find out first why they killed Mr. Morton. Yeah, because like that's important. So Roger sends someone outside to see about him, and we find out that he's indeed still alive, and he had actually kind of run off. And I hope I say it right, Gallagher. I know if it's spelled differently and it's Irish, it's pronounced Gallagher, but I don't know if there's a difference. Gallega, I don't know. Gallagher, a Glaswegian, speaks, and he's saying what happened. Like Isaiah did this, he ran away, he's off in the bush, whatever, and the Browns were now completely bewildered by him. Oh, well. And I actually have some sympathy for the Browns.
Glaswegian is a very specific accent. And I mean, I'm not going to say I've never had trouble understanding it. And I'm sure there are phrases now that I would not immediately go, Oh, I know what he's saying. We're enamored with it. We listen for it. We hear it. If you were not ready for that and somebody just came in and started like spewing that at you, you'd be like, wait, what?
It's definitely, I don't want to say it's an acquired taste. I don't think it's acquired at all. I like it. But absolutely, if you haven't been in it for a while, or even if you're good at recognizing it, and then you like when the time we're at 24 hours, less than that. But I mean, I lived there for a year. I dated a Scot for 4 years. So I definitely have a lot of latent whatever to I was like, pick it up. I don't produce it because that's not good. It's not my place to, you know, do someone's accent. But when we go there and we've communicated with people enough, often enough that we understand it. And yeah, like Summer said, it's there may be phrases, or someone may have like a really thick style of speech or really dense or something that, you know, a personal style or whatever that we don't recognize, but it just takes a minute or not even maybe a minute or three, a little bit of talking and finding out. And as long as you know the context, it's a lot easier to kind of figure that out if there's something. And so, yeah, so I find as long as it's English, meaning the language English or British English, whatever, as long as it's British English, I can understand most of the thickest Glaswegian accents, most of the thickest Scottish accents regionally.
But let's be honest. Situationally, if you're not ready for it, you might miss the first like couple sentences and be like, wait, what?
It can take a sentence or two or three to have your ear just confirm what you're hearing.
Yeah, just not to establish.
Not the meaning, just confirm. Yeah, it's Scottish, it's Glaswegian. You're going to have to listen a little harder. Okay, fine. I kind of tuned that, I turned into that dial. Now give it to me again. Yeah, it can definitely, if you're not expecting it, like, I think that's why it's not that difficult to mostly understand it, you know, right off the plane, because we completely expect it. And then, of course, well, I don't always listen to Scottish stuff on the plane, but yeah, when you're going there and you're fully like mentally prepared, yeah, it's not really a surprise. But yeah, if you're not expecting it, So most of the time these days, when I have a problem understanding something or someone, it's not typically because of an accent, something as I perceive as an accent. Because of course, when you're over there, we're the ones with the accents. It is usually me not understanding something is not about how it's said, meaning, or how I perceive it, meaning an accent, but the language used. And typically that's going to be Scots. It can still be Glaswegian. Like they can have slang and everything, but a lot of time they do speak Scots or a mixture of English and Scots. And so yeah, it's that I definitely don't know. I know a few phrases, but no. So I love listening to it, but I didn't like guffaw, but I really enjoyed reading this because I was like, you know, Browns, I understand. And the funny thing was, Mrs. Brown whispers, "What did he say?"
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And Roger translates. So, what was this whole shebangy bangy with Morton? What the heck? What the heck? Why are they trying to shoot him, kill him, anything? What's going on? Mr. Brown says, quote, "He's dishonored my daughter," unquote. Well, that's a reason. Diana comes up with one of her great name callings, quote, "grass-livered spittle snake." Summer, what's the best name you've ever called someone?
I believe I called you a piece of...
Summer, I had to leave, like, all that out. When
exactly.
Did you say that? It
sounds familiar. Do you not remember?
No.
We went to the drive-in, like, probably 20 years ago at this point. I was cursing and you said, "Summer, don't curse." And I was like, "Oh, really?" And then I just started like letting loose every curse word I could think of in combination with other words. And the last,
did I laugh,
like,
or was I horrified?
You laughed at the end. But at the very end, the last
you laughed at
the last
end.
Four words I spoke to you were "piece of..."
Oh,
and
okay,
that,
no more,
became,
I have to...
that became my favorite curse word ever, or curse phrase.
Do you ever use it for anybody else?
Amongst people who know about it.
Oh, okay.
I just used it earlier this week, actually.
Not around me. I missed it.
Not to you, to somebody else.
Oh, I missed out.
Who also knew about it.
Oh, but not about me.
No, not about you.
Not the origin story?
No, they knew the origin story.
Oh, okay.
But
is it a he or a her?
It's a her.
Alicia, that daughter who went hysterical, who got, I think, got water poured on her and had her apron over her head, is hopeful because she
doesn't want him to die.
Well, of course not. But my point was by Diana telling us, right? Because she could be hopeful over there in the corner, making googly eyes, relief eyes, whatever. But Diana didn't have to point it out. She could have been doing it without us knowing. But the fact that Diana pointed it out means she wants us to know. Oh, he's alive.
Tell me more about him doing it. You said he could be doing it. So tell me more about
doing
it.
What?
I don't know. You're the one who were talking about people doing it.
Oh, I don't even know what I said or meant then. So Alicia is hopeful. And what this tells us, I wrote, oh, so she's the hussy. Brown, no slut shaming here.
Too late.
Even the term slut shaming is, to me, I don't even like that term.
It hurts my ears.
Is it what? You're shaming a slut? Well, don't even use the word slut. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but then how would you explain what you were doing?
Well, because that's the term now. There needs to be a better term.
I know.
But that's not our job. Okay.
But okay.
No, you can talk to me.
I mean, it's not our job to come up with a better term for it. And I would never claim to be a person with the skills to come up with a better term for it. But you use the term slut shame to try, in my understanding, to try to reclaim the use of it. While also point your finger at the other person who is, you know, doing it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I hate the fact that, and I don't disagree with the meaning, like everyone's on board. Someone could be an active slut shamer, like do it and not be sorry for it, but still understand and agree, quote unquote, with the terminology. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
Like they could say, oh, I'm going to slut shame for if I see one or if I have a chance, I'll do it or whatever. I see nothing wrong with that. Someone still may do that and have like know what it means and have not have a problem with using it and actually do it actively as opposed to /and someone who like we're talking about or my usage or me saying, you know, I didn't mean to, I don't want to, etc. I'm just using it as the term to point out what I was, you know, even though it's a fictional character, not wanting to do. But I'm just like, yeah, I don't know what, because that's the term for it, right? Whether you do it or whether you are against it, it's still the term. And I almost wish I had a different name. I don't know what it would call it. I don't know what we call it, but Brown, I don't know which one, but probably the dad, brings up his gun again, and the militiamen all raise their guns. So this, man, this made me laugh. Guns are not funny. Guns are scary. They can kill. However, I thought of an old Western summer where you have like a bar, the equivalent, the closest thing they have to a pub or a bar, and guns are up, guns are down. One person brings the guns up, like one gun up, and then like 12 guns pointed at him. It's almost comical. And I could just imagine, we don't know what they're going to do or how they're going to show it or if they're going to show it, but I can just imagine, you know, the like the blocking. So what to do with the dude? And this is where I wrote, what would Jamie do? WWJD. Well, he did the one thing he, Roger, could think of. He sang.
Did he? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
He sang? I don't recall him singing.
You didn't read that?
No, I remember him being like, go get the whiskey and we'll just all hang out.
I totally made that up.
Okay.
It just took about 30 seconds for you to realize
like,
that
what
I did.
Are you talking about?
So he did the one thing he could think of. They, him and his men, become customers of the Browns. They buy things, but they also share their whiskey. Quote, and with any luck, by the time it was all drunk, Jamie Fraser would be there. Unquote. Megan P. writes, Roger and Fergus make an excellent team, the newbie and the veteran. I must say, I'm impressed with Roger's aggressive approach. I didn't anticipate that from him, and I like that his character development is always surprising me. I also love Fergus's laissez-faire entrance. Casual stroll in, polite, no-nonsense instructions, and seemingly cool as a cucumber. I hope they keep this scene because it will be a good one. Roger is smart to table the larger issue and get everyone calm and drinking together. It will be interesting to see how this plays out.
And that was chapter 28. Now moving on to chapter 29, entitled One Third of a Goat.
I don't know why this makes me laugh, but that title is redonk.
I still think it was a wasted opportunity to have chapter 2020 be chapter 20.
Oh, yeah. We've heard that, and we respect that opinion. Back with the J&C. And I don't mean the JC, I mean J and C. They're still at the Beardsleys, but they're finishing up. They wanted to get a move on already. Mr. B. Beardsley was buried. It was done. Mrs. Beardsley was gonna come with them. She's like, I'm not staying here, bitches. Or see you later, my bitches. I don't know. She didn't say any of that. But she was gonna go with them. At who knows how long, how far. But she was bringing the goats. Lorraine B. writes, with the horror of Mr. Beardsley's death barely behind them, Claire and Jamie find they have some unforeseen tag-alongs. Mrs. Beardsley decides there's a better life to be had in Brownsville, and she brings the goats with her. We meet Hiram, he of the melon-sized, or persimmon-sized, balls.
Because she can't just let anybody have anything. Because Jamie was like, doesn't Jamie say something about them being the size of melons? And she's like, well, persimmons at least.
She's like, I'm not going to let that. Saying.
Was it necessary?
He
was clearly using hyperbole. Everybody knows he was using hyperbole. There's no reason to be like the Debbie Downer of every situation, Claire.
So she's basically metaphorical ball shaming Jamie's compliment of the goat.
That's not a thing, but sure, if that's the way you want to phrase it.
So Claire asks, it's not far, is it? And Jamie replies, do you ken how fast a goat walks, Sassenach? the goats end up roped together. Honestly, I have to see this. Please, powers that be, bring us the goats. The roped together goats, and quote, like a gang of jovially inebriate convicts. I love that line. Mrs. Beardsley went on Mrs. Piggy. So they're like, how are we going to do this? The goats obviously got to walk. Jamie and Claire had two horses, and Mrs. Beardsley's, you know, not if they let her walk, well, they're going to have to go slow because of the goats anyway. But they put Mrs. Beardsley on Mrs. Piggy, and Claire doubles up with Jamie. So, and there's a baby kid, or a baby kid, that's kind of redundant. Mrs. Beardsley is holding the kid, the baby goat, while sitting on Mrs. Piggy. So Claire was with Jamie, as I said. Mrs. Beardsley says, quote, we should go before moonrise. She comes out then.
That's not what she said.
I know, but I don't want to make fun of a lisp.
Fine. A what?
A lisp.
Because I thought you said a lisp.
That would be very funny. No, I did not. And if I did, I apologize. So they left. Everyone is horsed or boarded. Everyone's boarded the horses. Everyone is atop the horses. They're ready to go. The goats are roped, everything. And they see that they left, or I guess they weren't up yet, but they left the door open. Whoopsie. And none of them like wanted to go near that house again. They're like, I'm done. Quote, Marianne, she was the last one. The last what? The last wife, meaning last before Mrs. Beardsley. Quote, she stands under the rowan tree at moonrise. And I have an idea. Let's go. And Claire's all, shouldn't we close the door? And Jamie's like, fine, I'll do it.
I'll do it. But you get on the horse and you'll be ready to get out of here. Because he's like me in the middle of the night. If I need to get something through a dark room, I creep over there. And as soon as I get it and turn the light off, I run back to bed. Still now, I'm a grown person. I still do it. Because I don't want the thing that's underneath the bed to catch my feet as I'm climbing
on. Summer, you're too funny. So
you know it's there.
They find... Shut up. They don't find. As they're not so fast walking away, Jamie and Claire have a little chat about that rowan tree. And it wasn't a rowan tree after all. It was a mountain ash. Now, they do look kind of similar. And it was actually chosen on purpose and planted by a lot of Scots in the colonies in North Carolina. It kind of reminded them.
It resembled it.
It reminded them of home. Now they're on their way to Brownsville officially. And I think it's Roger. It's not Roger. I think it's Claire. But someone says, because I didn't write it down, quote, "I hope Roger's managed all right."
Oh, she okay, doesn't know.
Okay, let me
know.
Ask you this. This is a great question. This is great. Okay. What?
But her wants for him was not just that he was okay. It was like, I hope he gets a nice bed at an inn and it's soft and he slept. And I'm like, Brownsville. It sounds to me that Brownsville is some dude's house with the last name of Brown. It's not a town. They're not all hanging out in the lap of luxury.
So forget what her wishes or wonderings are. We know what happened to, at least thus far, to Roger, right? And they're welcome. We know what happened to Jamie and Claire and that stanky mess. So we have two things that happened. Sex aside, character. I don't care about the character, the gender, sex. I don't care. If you had to go on one of those journeys, which one do you go on?
Brownsville. Very much Brownsville.
That's a hard decision.
There's not an apoplectic, burned stroke victim that needs to be murdered.
But he can't do anything.
In a loft, covered in piss and that needs to then be lowered down and then buried.
But you don't, he can't hurt you. Whereas in Brownsville, you can be shot.
They're not going to hurt him. There's more of them than there are of them. And you can pick which one I mean.
So I have to answer the same question. So I think I would choose the Beardsleys.
You want the poopy man? The poopy gangrene man? It stinks and blah.
No, I don't want the poopy man. I just don't want to have a chance to get shot.
I think you could. I mean, you're one of a large group if you were in the Brownsville group, right? There's a bunch of you. The odds of you being the one standing next to Isaiah are pretty slim.
So I am curious, would you guys, and this will be one of our little like promotional tweet things, would you guys, knowing exactly what happened in the last chapter or two chapters ago? No, last chapter in Brownsville to Roger and the party, and two chapters ago with Jamie and Claire, Mrs. Beardsley, all the stuff. I'm not talking about Brownsville. I'm not talking about the Beardsley's farm like just a few days ago when Keziah was there. I'm talking about only the period of time Jamie and Claire were there and only the period of time between Roger and the dude's arrival in Brownsville, their welcome, up through when they became customers and drank whiskey and we ended the chapter. So those exact time periods, which would you choose? I think I'm going to go with Beardsley's.
No, you're wrong.
Summers.
Because
it's not
everyone,
wrong.
It is wrong. And let me tell you why it's wrong. And wrong, I mean, it's wrong. There's no.
Your opinion is wrong.
No, it's wrong. So here's what's going to happen. When Brownsville ends, they're all getting drunk and hanging out together. When the Beardsley farm ends, they're burying a gigantic dead man and then escaping from ghosts. And then fighting off cougars in the wilderness and then splinting goats. And then it just goes on and on. Which would you choose? I would rather be drinking whiskey after a very short skirmish.
It's not about the ending.
It is. It's absolutely about the ending.
No, it's about what could happen. It's about the whole thing. It's not the ending. The ending, I agree. That ending is better. But if you... They're just lucky.
It was resolved so quickly. The Brownsville The Brownsville issue with starting with a dude being shot at to everyone drinking whiskey together, that issue was small. In fact, it was like 4 pages small. And then we move on to the next chapter, which is at least 20 pages. And it's much longer and full of burying dead men and ghosts.
Dear listener, what would you guys choose? I'm very curious.
Brownsville.
Claire, healer and caring wife that she is working to get Jamie to clear his At first I wrote this to clear his throat. But I don't think it was, I mean, it doesn't hurt, but I don't, it's not for medicinal purposes. She's just wanting him, it's kind of a game. The highest number of times she's gotten him to like say or whatever that noise is 3. So she's trying to get it to see how many times she can get his reply. And he's not really up much for this conversation.
He's so sick.
I know. She keeps verbalizing her observations. And so it's basically a way Claire is trying to entertain herself. I love it. Oh, Lorraine B. writes, the goats are described as, quote, six goats roped together like a gang of jovially inebriate convicts, unquote. And they ambled along with the liveliest interest, snatching mouthfuls of dry grass, bumping into one another and the horses, and generally sounding like a herd of elephants in the crackling underbrush. Unbeknownst to Jamie, Claire tries to make him respond in many different ways in a row, and all are accompanied with Claire's witty descriptions. It was very easy for me to see the goats bumbling along and hear Jamie's responses. Totally had me chuckling. So here we are lulled. This is true. Here we are lulled into complacency. Then Gideon loses his ever-loving shiznit. There is pandemonium. We find out it was a big cat. That ain't no adso, yo. So Claire, like everyone, like the horses went one way. Claire's knocked off the horse. Jamie's like, it was crazy town. And Claire's like, the wind was knocked out of her. But she's like, she got her bearings. Well, not bearings, but she was able to get herself up and kind of crawl around until she found like a log to kind of hide halfway next to. Jamie ultimately comes and finds her in the dark, and he takes her to a goat who'd been hurt. The cat had taken one of the nannies, and Hiram, his leg had been broken. And Mrs. Beardsley tells him, well, I just gave it away, but Mrs. Beardsley tells them the goat's name is Hiram. And she says, he's a good boy. Quote, Lorraine B. writes, Diana, quote, what the hell? Lorraine B. writes, Diana easily creates both an eerie, sinister atmosphere and one that's humorous and lighthearted. She contrasts the goats, Claire's silly little game with Claire's mounting uneasiness, with Mrs. Beardsley's actions concerning her husband and her description of a ghost. She also scares us in a different way when a cougar attacks them. Claire has Jamie grab some things to help her. The dude, Hiram, was going mental. Like, he didn't want to say he's in pain. He's trying to get up. He didn't want to stay still. He's freaked out. And Claire's like, it's might not be that bad because there's no blood or anything, but shock could kill him. And so she's trying to calm him. And so Jamie brings over the kid and lowers it down to where Hiram can smell his son, right? Because he's got a harem. So Hiram's harem. They're all his spermalings. And so he lowers her down so Hiram can smell his kid, literally, whatever. And that calms him. And so he has something else to pay attention to. He's distracted. I'm sure his cortisol is going down or his oxytocin. I don't know what happens when a goat, billy goat, smells his kid. I don't know. But he was calmer.
Like his adrenaline?
Yeah. Well,
he was, you know.
Yeah, whatever. He probably his blood pressure went down, if nothing else.
Did you say oxytocin?
I did.
Okay. That was the word that was coming to my brain, and I didn't know if it was because I just heard you say it
maybe, or so.
It was because I was smart.
Could have been both, but I did just say it. So it was the kid's mom, we find out, poor baby, who'd been taken. So Hiram tries to stand and he falls over. And by this time, Claire has basically used the ropes and the sticks and the whatever she got from Jamie to splint his leg. Hiram tries to stand, he falls over, and it kind of breaks, not the silence, it kind of breaks, not breaks the ice, but gives a little bit of levity to the situation. Like, yes, someone or a goat was killed. Yes, a goat was hurt. And yes, they could have been more hurt. And yes, they could have been attacked. But everyone's, for the most part, everyone's okay. And so it kind of...
It's all perspective.
Exactly. And so everyone kind of giggles. And Jamie says, quote, now I shall decide what to do, unquote. Now, does that remind you of anything? that's if you have to say that's a no. I know you well.
So no?
At the end of the, like two chapters ago, three chapters ago, at the end of...
Oh, when he's like, I'm going to have to figure out what to do now.
Yes, he's okay. Like, now we've got the twins. Like, okay. I don't know what...
I just assumed you were going to make an outside of book reference. I didn't realize we were literally rewinding 2 weeks.
Rewind. I'm just saying, he just said this. It may have been slightly different words, but it was exact same, very similar words and exact same sentiment. And I'm like, poor Jamie. So wait, like, Jamie, you said that a few chapters ago and you ended up at the Beardsleys. So maybe. Who knows, dear listener? We'll see what have to see what happens when he gets to Brownsville, because that may be some shiz happening there too. So there were too many dangers to continue that night. So there's just no way. They lost the trail. They were already attacked. Their party was already attacked by a big cat. So they end up camping for the night. They encourage the kid, who's now an orphan. Well, not an orphan. Excuse me. He has one parent alive. But the kid, who is now motherless, to feed from another nanny. And thankfully, he does eventually. Now, Claire's not afraid of another cat sneaking up on them. She says the horse, she tells Mrs. Beardsley that the horses would let them know. So that is true. Like, that's a good, I mean, if your horse starts freaking out, then you probably better freak out. but it's a good warning system. So that's right. Mrs. Beardsley, we find out she didn't know anyone in Brownsville where they were on their way. And we finally get Mrs. Beardsley's story. Mr. Beardsley had basically bought her from her father and brought her from Maryland, where she was, to his house here in North Carolina, where she'd basically been a prisoner. Her only companion-ish had been Keziah. She'd been in North Carolina for 2 years. Quote, 2 years, 3 months, 5 days. Hence those marks on the doorpost. Now, do you remember how long? Because two things that were said here. So she says her only quote-unquote companion had been this deaf stable boy. Of course, we know that as Keziah, who just left. But that had been her only companion for 2 years. So that falls very much in line with the same 2 years that Josiah had left, right? So because we were told that he had left 2 years ago and he had taken, you know, not sweet time, but he had taken the right time to not only build skills himself, but to find the right living situation where he make it safe enough so that he could go back and get Keziah to bring him out and actually have something, a safe place to take him to. So it makes sense. Because I was like, 2 years, that's a long time. I was like, no, not really. Because, I mean, it is, but it has been only Keziah there. So Josiah was gone. So Mrs. Beardsley's first name is Frances, and her mother called her Fanny. And her mother had,
what was it?
Her mother had died when she was.
What was it? Was it Frances?
Summer. Yes, I think she said that.
You could.
her mother had died when she was 12, and her father was a crabber. So they lived on the coast in Maryland. So what had been her plan after Mr. Beardsley had died? So maybe not early days, but once she had realized that he was. Had a stroke and she was like burning him and barely keeping him alive. And she knew he was going to eventually die. What was her plan? Well, Marianne, she kind of goes back and talks about this, a dead wife. So Marianne had been the fourth Mrs. Beardsley. She'd talked to Fanny. She'd been the only one he had buried under the rowan tree. The rest were buried somewhere in the woods. So he first saw her when Mr. Beardsley first saw Marianne, right? The dead woman. Mm-hmm. Okay. When Mr. Beardsley first saw Marianne post earthly life, Fanny thought that Mr. Beardsley would get upset. And so she went outside to warn her. Now, upset meaning like scared, upset meaning like, why didn't you die or stay dead? I don't know what that means, but she thought he would be irritated or something in some way, and she didn't want to, you know, cause it. She doesn't need any more drama. So she went outside to warn her. Now, Fanny seems intent upon proving her story to Claire. Claire's like, that's all good. I believe you. No. We don't need to see the graves. I get you. I believe you, honey. Fanny confirms that Mr. Beardsley had killed his wives, and she, Fanny, would have been killed too, except that Marianne had stopped him. So it's all very timely. So just about a month before, the night he'd had the stroke, he'd intended / tried to kill Fanny. Marianne, the ghost, had knocked on the door and numerous times, and she never like opened it. They She never like pushed it open, and they never opened it to her at first. But Marianne had knocked on the door, and he's trying to kill or get to Fanny. She's up in the loft. He runs up after her, but he starts having a fit or his seizure, a stroke as he's reaching the top of the ladder. And he kind of falls forward enough so he's not like on the floor and he's not halfway up. He's mostly up because there's no way she could have pulled him up. But she couldn't pull him or move him to get him down. So she had to pull the rest of his body up into the loft. So Jamie shows up at this point and startles Claire. So Claire is so, I don't want to say not in love with, but like listen intent on hearing Fanny's ghost story, that she is easily startled. Jamie reports that he has found a place for them to camp. He gets Claire to help him with the goat, meaning Hiram. And that about finished him. Like, he's holding Hiram, I think, over his head, over his neck, like two hooves on either side, or over his shoulders. And they get to the place, and he like kneels down and puts the goat down. He's like, Sassenach, I'm done. Like, I literally cannot go another step. And that's a big deal. That is a freaking big deal. Because Jamie, he will admit stuff to Claire, but he's not as far as his limitations go. He's not shy with her, but as a man, it is still hard for him to, you know, admit that, even though he does love her. When Jamie says something like, I can't go any further, Sassenach, she knows, like, she got a little scared. She was like, oh crap. Like, he's done for right now. He truly is ill, and he's exhausted, and he needs to sleep and like get, he just needs to rest. So she finishes setting up camp and moving the horses and getting the fire ready and then she unleashes the goose grease. So as we already said several times, the last few chapters, Jamie was sick. They review what, because he had been out hunting or campsite hunting, they review what Fanny had told Claire about Marianne, the ghost, Mr. Beardsley, his apoplexy, his death, or his apoplexy, the loft, everything. By the time she puts away her supplies and returns to their area, both he and Fanny are asleep. She sees him smile in his sleep, and she realizes that she hadn't seen that since their early years of their marriage at Lallybroch. Jamie Fraser was happy. Lorraine B. closes us out with, but as Mrs. Beardsley says that they should be away before moonrise and Claire gets an icy chill down her back, so begins an eerie story that rivals the Tanisk story from Voyager that Jamie recounts about why Gavin Hayes hates the dark. I thought that was in just after he dies, which is in early Drums of Autumn. Remember, he's hanged? And they tell him,
and they have this story, yeah.
So I think it's in early Drums of Autumn, but you're right. It is Gavin Hayes, and it is about the Tanisk. I think that's how it's pronounced. So Gavin Hayes had hated the dark. We hear about the ghost of Mr. Beardsley's fourth wife and how she scared him into having an apoplexy. Diana ramps up the tension when Claire recalls Mrs. Beardsley's systematic and cold-blooded torture of her husband and how Claire freaks more than a little when Mrs. Beardsley laughs.
And that was chapter 29. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapters 30, Spawn of Satan, and chapter 31, entitled Orphan of the Storm. And as always, if you'd like to contribute to our read-along, if you go to www.outlanderpod.com/fierycross, you'll find a link to our spreadsheet. And we are going to have our the next grouping of chapters available very shortly to sign up to contribute for. If you go on that webpage and you make a comment on the event, and I will add you to the spreadsheet.
And in their comment, they need to say what chapters they'd like.
Which chapters they want. Okay. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, if you want to be specific. I mean, if you just put your name down, I'll assign them. If you need me to assign them, I'll do that.
Summer will say, hi, how are you? How's your day? She probably won't because she doesn't.
And then I'll assign you. I'll give you the long chapters.
Oh, gosh. And as always, though, if we'd love to have you help us continue the conversation in our Facebook community. You can join us at outlanderpod.com/group. That was 300. That was 300.
That was really, I feel like that came out of nowhere.
Kind of. Well, no, speak for yourself. That did not come out of nowhere, but I get what you're saying. We always appreciate you guys listening. 300 episodes is kind of big, kind of a big deal. And we will likely, because of upcoming travel and upcoming things, we will likely not do a giveaway in tandem with this, but we will do a giveaway celebrating 300 episodes. Does that sound good?
Sure.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.